From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. With an estimated 1.5 million internally displaced persons in Iraq facing dire conditions, the UN's relief agency is making a major push into the country. Patrick Maigwa reports from the United Nations.
A major humanitarian operation to reach close to 500,000 people displaced in northern Iraq is being launched by the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. The air, road and sea operation will begin on Wednesday, starting with a four-day airlift of humanitarian supplies from Aqaba in Jordan to Erbil, followed by road convoys from Turkey and Jordan, and sea and land shipments from Dubai. Displaced people, mainly from Iraqi minority groups, have sought refuge in Duhok Governorate of the Kurdistan region, escaping violence unleashed by militant groups on the city of Sinjar and its neighboring areas. Adrian Edwards from UNHCR says Iraq's current humanitarian challenges are immense, with most of the displaced living rough in schools, mosques, churches, and unfinished buildings.
The major focus of this push is on improving living conditions for the displaced in the region, particularly people without shelter or housing. Conditions remain desperate for those without access to suitable shelter, for people struggling to find food and water to feed their families, and for those without access to primary medical care. Many are still coming to grips with the tragedy they've been through in recent weeks, fleeing homes with nothing, and many are trying to cope with the loss of loved ones. Included in the initial aid shipments will be 3,300 tents, 20,000 plastic sheets, 18,500 kitchen sets, and 16,500 jerry cans. The needs are not confined to Kurdistan. There are other camps or sites in other governorates where displaced people have gathered, including in Sulaymaniyah, Diyala, and Kirkuk. The Iraqi government has also set up three caravan centres for the displaced in Baghdad.
Last week, the United Nations declared its highest level of emergency in Iraq to facilitate mobilization of additional resources to meet the growing humanitarian needs of populations affected by forced displacements. An upsurge of violence in Iraq has displaced over 1.2 million people since the beginning of the year. Patrick Maigwa, United Nations, Geneva.
The 1.5 million displaced persons are in addition to the more than 4 million Iraqi refugees living abroad and 1.2 million internally displaced who were forced to flee as a consequence of the two U.S. wars and decade of U.S. sanctions and bombings against their country. Unrest in Pakistan has the government itself under siege. We have this report from Press TV.
Their sit-in keeps going on. The leader of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, Imran Khan, and prominent religious cleric Thairul Qadri are leading separate protests in the Pakistani capital to seek the ouster of the current Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Monday was an eventful day as party of Imran Khan decided to resign from the parliament as part of its efforts to put pressure on the government to accept its demands. The party will also quit from the provincial assemblies except from Northwest Frontier Province where it has formed the government.
We want Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who has come into power through rigging, to resign immediately, and an independent election commission be formed, which is with the consensus of all political parties, and an interim government, which is with the consensus of all stakeholders, all political parties, which is acceptable to everyone, and then midterm elections immediately.
As a result of mounting pressure, the Chief Minister of Pakistan's biggest province, Punjab, and younger brother of Prime Minister, Shehbaz Sharif, has offered to resign to end the political crisis. The government is also seeking to resolve the issue through dialogue.
The government of Pakistan has decided to resolve the political crisis through dialogue. The two committees have been formed to hold negotiations with Imran Khan and Tahirul Qadri. We are ready to accept their demands if they are within the constitutional framework.
The announcement comes a day after Imran Khan decided to launch a civil disobedience movement against the government.
Political experts believe that in the absence of a negotiated settlement, the standoff will linger on. However, the real test for these protesters and their leadership lies with how long they can sustain this anti-government movement. Kamran Yusuf, Press TV, Islamabad.
Journalist Javad Rahner spoke with Press TV late Monday and laid out his assessment of the prospects for the Prime Minister and his government.
I think it's not basically what we see on the ground. What is behind the scene, that is more important. On the ground, we see some thousands of people, they're protesting against the government. They've been here for the last 5 days, and probably even if they are allowed to enter the red zone, or even if there are clashes, that is not important. There have been violence in Pakistan, and that has been part of the everyday life. That is unfortunately a routine part of Pakistan's political scene. But bigger problem here is what goes behind the political scene. How army is going to retaliate? In what manner army is going to move on this particular issue? Because of these apprehensions in Pakistan, there's the political temperature is rising. Options for the government is exhausting. Option for the opposition parties are also exhausting, because these protesters who are running into probably into 30,000, some say it's the 40,000, they cannot sustain their sit-in for a longer period of time. But for the government, in case they allow these protesters to go inside the red zone, there are apprehensions that they might run over the parliament, they might run over some of the Western embassies. So because of this reason, the government is reluctant. Nonetheless, there is an option for the government to allow these protesters to come into the red zone to avoid any bloodshed, because that is going to be the focal point, and that is what the opposition parties are trying to achieve. If there is a violence, if there are casualties, if there are killing of people, then they think the military can intervene. That is something the government doesn't want to happen.
Although the ceasefire in Gaza has expired and Israel and Hamas began to exchange fire almost immediately, some assessment of the damage in Gaza was made during the lull. According to a UN humanitarian aid official, more than 17,000 housing units alone have been destroyed by Israeli attacks. Press TV's Akram Al-Sattari gave this report from Gaza.
It's very difficult for the people of Gaza to retrieve the normalcy to their lives, and it's very difficult for Gazans also to live about the destruction that has been caused to the infrastructure. I'm reporting from Khuza'a. I have been there for the second news bulletin. I have been seeing the houses of the people, have been assessing the damage that has been caused to the infrastructure. I have been talking to the people who are affected, to children who are trying to rescue injured children, to civilians who are dying under the rubble of their houses in this very small area. Khuza'a, by the way, is a very small village in Khan Yunis city, and in this very small village, at least 450 houses were destroyed. At least 450 houses were reduced to rubble, and the people who lost these houses are still trying to find their dear under the rubble of those houses. And this example is one small example about the widespread destruction that has been caused to the Gaza Strip and to the places of the people and to the civilians in the Gaza Strip. As was stated by the UN envoy to the UN, Rupert Sirri, he said that two-thirds of the people who are killed were civilians, and I'm correcting this. Two-thirds of the people who are killed are only women, children, and elderly people, while the other third is young men, and those young men are also civilians. Israel was targeting for the past few 37 days, was targeting the Palestinians at large, and their strategy tells that they were trying to cause the widespread destruction to the infrastructures and to civilians, while they failed miserably to bring an end to the military ongoing campaign against Palestinian resistance. And I have with me here the former mayor of Khuza'a village, and I talked to him, and we are talking to him now to tell us about the destruction that has been caused. Good afternoon. You have been here. We talked several times about the destruction that has been caused. Has Israel been targeting military people or civilians in the area, and what is the effect of their military activities in the area?
Actually, Khuza'a population is about 15,000 capita. Israeli army entered this village. It was a unique village. It was a very ideal village. 1999, I have invited 50 Israeli mayors, all the mayors of the villages around Gaza Strip. They visited me here in this town, and they said this is very unique and very ideal. Village is very clean, environmental health is available, oxygen, it's trees, a lovely, beautiful town. All tourists from Gaza Strip, they used to visit this place because it's very clean and very nice. Actually, they targeted all the houses, all the civilian, all the trees, all the streets, all the infrastructure of this town. A man old about 105 years, 105 years is old. They targeted him and they killed him. He was the oldest man in the Eastern Village in about... between about 150,000 persons, he was the eldest, and they killed him. A soldier appeared from the tank, and they told him, go this way, to the west side. And he walked about 15 meters, then another tank targeted him, and they killed him between the eyes. This is the Israelis. They killed ladies, kids, children, old men. We pulled out about 20 remains of residents people from this town, but not as big as they have destroyed house. They destroyed it in this town. They destroyed about 450 houses. This is mass destruction, completely destructed, and about 850 houses. It was targeting by cannons and by heavy rifles, by guns. It's very difficult to the people now. Winter is coming, you know, and it's very difficult to the people to cope with this situation. It's a very bad situation. Though we have a very high level of unemployment before the war, and we have, the people here, they live under the poverty line, you know, about 70%. Under the poverty line, and they're suffering a lot, you know. They it's very difficult for them to live and to cope with the situation. But the Israelis came as well, and they destroyed everything. They increased our problems, our disaster. I can call this thing it's the disaster of the century. It's the disaster of this century. They targeted all civilians. As I said, we pulled about 20 remains of resistance people from this town. But why, suppose these 20 persons spread, each one was sitting in a house. It means they have to destroy 20 houses only, but not 250 houses. They destroyed everything in this town. They're targeting it. This is the civilization of the, they said, there is a slogan. They said this is the most civilized army in the worldwide. But I believe it's not, never. They are brutal army. They are very brutal army. They destroyed a civilization. They destroyed life here. 1999, I invited 50 mayors of Israeli villages, and they came here, and we welcomed them. We gave them food, we gave them drinks, and they visited our houses. They did very good round around the town, and they said, this is very ideal, very unique village. We will support you. We'll support you to make it more better, this village. And that's what they bring to us. That's what they brought. You know, they destroyed life. They destroyed everything.
So this is the image in the Gaza Strip. The ideal places are being targeted. The lives of people are being taken. The houses of people are being destroyed and reduced to rubble. The hopes of Palestinians are being targeted by the most civilized army that is calling itself a civilized army. But Palestine will still be there. People of Khuzaa and the people of Gaza Strip at large, and Palestine also, will survive despite all odds. But they will have to answer many questions and will have to overcome many challenges with no aid at all, and even with the minimum aid that is coming in. This is the image in Khuzaa and in Gaza Strip at large. And back to you now.
As we reported yesterday, Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, called for the investigation of the crash of the Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 over East Ukraine to be internationalized. Citing UN Security Council Resolution number 2166, all fighting was to stop in the region of the crash. However, the Kiev government's forces have continued to both shell the area and conduct aerial bombardments, making a sustained presence at the site impossible. More than a month has passed since the crash on July 17th of the airliner in the Donetsk region of Ukraine while en route from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. All 298 people on board were killed. But to date, no report has been released on the progress in the investigation, despite Security Council protocols calling for periodic reporting. There was no word on the Security Council's response to Churkin's request Monday, which was made in a closed session. Meanwhile, Ukrainian cable providers could face heavy fines or have their licenses revoked if they broadcast Russian media channels, including RT. The Russian broadcasts were earlier suspended by a series of Ukrainian court orders. An advisor to Ukraine's Interior Ministry, Anton Gerashenko, said in a statement on his Facebook page, quote, "Ukraine is a sovereign state and must defend its media space from outside aggression from Russia," closed quote. Kiev has promised total monitoring of all outlets, including hotels, sanatoriums, and hospitals, which have been instructed to switch off their Russian channel feeds, quote, "before officers of the law pay a visit," closed quote. While the U.S. is well known around the world for its regular, if selective, condemnation of foreign governments over issues ranging from the violent repression of protest to official interference with the press, with the recent examples of Libya, Syria, and Ukraine resulting in an 8-month bombing campaign, the arming and funding of anti-government military groups, and a new Cold War, respectively, the uprising in Ferguson, Missouri, has left the U.S. State Department exposed to criticism from governments and citizens around the world. The State Department's deputy spokesperson, Marie Harf, got a taste of it from reporters at her daily press conference Tuesday.
It seems as though the situation in Ferguson has turned into something of a free-for-all for governments around the world who the U.S. is particularly critical of in terms of human rights records, are now taking aim at the United States and the situation there. I'm wondering first, just generally, if you have any response to that.
I do. Look, we here in the United States will put our record for confronting our problems transparently and honestly and openly up against any other countries in the world. When things occur, as you've heard the president speak about, we look at them, as I said, transparently, honestly, and openly, and we, of course, would suggest that other countries do the same thing.
And do you believe that any of these, a short list of these countries includes Egypt, Iran, Bahrain, Russia, China, Zimbabwe. I'm wondering if you think that any of their any criticism coming from these countries is particularly is either welcome or appropriate.
Well, look, people are free to say whatever they want. That's something we believe in very deeply here, is freedom of expression. But I would certainly strongly disagree with the notion that what's happening here is comparable in any way to situations in some of those countries you've named. As I said, and this is really a domestic issue, but briefly, when we have problems and issues in this country, we deal with them openly and honestly. We think that's important, and I would encourage the countries you named particularly to do the same thing. They haven't always done that, and we've been very clear when we believe they should.
The fighting in Ferguson has continued, despite the deployment of the Missouri National Guard to supplement an already militarized local police presence loaded with armored vehicles, machine guns, and other heavy weaponry. We begin with this report from RT's Anastasia Cherkina on the scene in Ferguson Monday evening.
Tonight is the eighth night that clashes continue to unravel between police and protesters here in Ferguson, Missouri, over the death of over the killing of 18-year-old unarmed Michael Brown. And right now we're standing on the central street of Ferguson, where behind me there's quite a heavy police presence, as has been the case every night. There are protesters facing the police, and we just minutes ago saw a crowd of people run away. If you can hear, the police right now are saying, don't throw things at the road, otherwise we will have to arrest you. They're also saying, please disperse or we will have to use tear gas. Of course, this has been an occurrence that has taken place mostly every night. Right now behind me, look, they're firing. This is either tear gas or smoke cannons that have also been used throughout these nights. They're firing tear gas at protesters or smoke grenades. Oh, our way. Let's go. So guys, tear gas right here on the streets of Ferguson. Oh my God. Woo!
On Tuesday, a 23-year-old African-American man was shot and killed by St. Louis Metropolitan Police less than 4 miles from the protests in Ferguson. The man was allegedly brandishing a knife. According to police reports, a pair of officers arrived to see the man acting erratically, grabbing his waistband and holding a knife. The police reportedly got out of their car and gave verbal commands for the man to drop the knife. According to police, he approached the officers in an aggressive manner. Both officers drew their guns and shot at him from a distance of 3 to 4 feet, killing him, according to police. There was a large protest in New York Monday against police brutality. We have this report from RT's Alexei Yaroshevsky.
National Guard!
Arrest the killer cops!
National Guard!
Arrest the killer cops!
Hands up! Don't shoot! Hands up! Don't shoot!
No more racists!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace! Justice for Michael! Justice for Michael!
Our lives mean something. Send them police officers under the damn jail. How do you spell racist?
N-Y-P-D.
Angry crowds have gathered in front of the police headquarters in New York, calling for an end to police brutality in Ferguson. Protests have been set up by the People's Power Assembly organization. Alexei Yaroshevsky was there for us.
It's another day, another protest in NYC regarding the events in Missouri. A couple of dozen people, even closer to 100. It's people here believe that police brutality has no interstate borders. And what we've heard here, asking the question whether these protests will continue, one of the activists told us that they will continue forever if it takes for the authorities to finally listen to the voice of the people and stop what they describe as increasing police brutality in this country. Alexei Yaroshevsky, RT, reporting from New York City.
President Obama spoke about the escalating situation in Ferguson Monday. RT's Gayan Chichikayan has this report.
What keeps people protesting after the killing of Michael Brown, the black unarmed teenager, is the perception that had he been white, he would have been alive today. They may not know all the details of the investigation, but they regularly see or hear about someone who was subject to racial profiling by the police. Even though America now has a president of color, racial bias in law enforcement is still a thorny issue. The president addressed it cautiously here.
In too many communities around the country, a gulf of mistrust exists between local residents and law enforcement. In too many communities, too many young men of color are left behind and seen only as objects of fear.
Ferguson, Missouri has looked like a war zone in recent days as people gathered to demand justice for Michael Brown. The police in Missouri used tear gas, deployed military vehicles, threatened and detained journalists. President Obama said there is no excuse for excessive use of force by the police, but he also blamed some of the protesters for provoking violence. He said there is a line between military and police, and it needs to be preserved. But with the state now ordering troops into Ferguson to keep protesters in check, that line seems even more blurred. What President Obama had to address was this lack of trust for law enforcement, which is only getting worse as police kill unarmed people and crack down on protests.
But journalist Arun Gupta pointed out that the actions of protesters have to be looked at in context.
Pattern of racist policing is institutionalized in this country. There have been reports for decades now. And so while I'm not going to sit here and say, like, yes, it's a great thing that stores are being burned, I also know what the real issue here is. It's state violence. It's a violent system that consigns many, especially African Americans, to a life of violence and poverty, and when they dare to poke their heads up, it gets smashed down by these militarized police. As what we've seen from Obama is a lot of equivocation, like trying to lump a few people who are looting in with the violent state response. These are not equals. So we can't rely on the political system alone to address this problem. It has to come from the people who organize themselves to force a change.
In Ferguson, the official response has been to blame the violence on outside agitators, a term reminiscent of the civil rights struggle, when white Southern officials blamed outsiders for sowing unrest among what they called at the time they are Negroes. Usually, the alleged and often imaginary agitators were either communists or Northerners still fighting the Civil War. But the term was also used in the aftermath of the urban uprisings in the 1960s in places like Watts, Detroit, and Newark. This was Captain Ron Johnson of the local highway patrol in Ferguson, a spokesperson for the police effort there, Monday night.
Protesters who shook hands with officers and expressed their opinions. This was the freedom of expression that we are committed to protecting. At 9:40 p.m., more than 200 people walked toward police officers at the corner of West Florissant and Ferguson Avenue. They were loud, but not aggressive. They came through the line of police officers, chanted, and then seemed to be turning around and thinning out. Police did not react. In fact, several of the protesters encouraged the crowd to turn around, indicating their message had been heard. But that's when bottles were thrown from the middle and the back of a large crowd that gathered near and within the media staging area. These criminal acts came from a tiny minority of lawbreakers. But anyone who has been at these protests understands that there is a dangerous dynamic in the night. It allows a small number of violent agitators to hide in the crowd and then attempt to create chaos. The catalyst can be bottles thrown, Molotov cocktails, and of course, shots fired. Protesters are peaceful and respectful. Protesters don't clash with police. They don't throw Molotov cocktails. It is criminals who throw Molotov cocktails and fire shots and endangers lives and property. In the dark of night, there were at least two people shot. We have been criticized for using SWAT trucks doing protests. We did not deploy those into the crowd until things deteriorated. And tonight, we used a SWAT truck and another large vehicle to get into a violent, dangerous area to extract a gunshot victim. Those vehicles not only provide protection for officers, tonight they help us get people who were wounded by gunfire and get them to safety. Tonight there were numerous reports of shots fired. We had two fires, one at a business and one at an unoccupied residence. In the area of West Florissant and Canfield, our officers came under heavy gunfire. Our officer confiscated two guns during a car stop near the media staging area. These are not acts of protesters, but acts of violent criminals. Our officers acted with professionalism. Once again, not a single bullet fired by officers, despite coming under heavy attack. Four St. Louis County police officers were hit by rocks and bottles and sustained injury. Because of the dangers posed tonight, I want to encourage the good people of this area to come out and protest tomorrow during the daytime hours. Make your voices heard when you can be seen and when you're not the cover for violent agitators. That is my suggestion. I'd like the people concerned about peace in Ferguson to consider that. As of 2 a.m., 31 people have been arrested tonight. I've said that many of the criminal element that have been coming to Ferguson are not from this area. Tonight, some of those arrested came from as far as away as New York and California. I want to address the role of the media and what is going on here. Tonight, media repeatedly had to be asked to return to the sidewalks and get out of the streets when clashes were going on in the streets. If these situations going on, we need to have that area clear. This is a matter of your safety and the safety of others. We need the roads clear so that we can safely and quickly remove vehicles to other sectors where people are under threat. Clearing the roads is a matter of safety. Please clear the roads when asked.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.